Mr. Schwartz.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Frederick Schwartz on behalf of the International Internship Program. Let me first briefly apologize for the typos that appeared in the brief. In consolidating them, apparently there were paragraphs that were misplaced and words that should not have been there, and I do apologize to the Court. Let me also say that this is a particularly important case, which may not be immediately apparent. As the Court may know, most of the decisions by the USCIS are protected from judicial review because they're discretionary, and the statute provides that. This is one of the very few areas where it is not discretionary, and consequently, a determination of arbitrary and capricious in this particular case will extend its influence, I believe, to a lot of other areas where the Court can't get its view known. Let me start with what is probably the elephant in the room, which is mootness. As the Court knows, there are two aspects of the exceptions to mootness, one of which is if there's a challenge to an ongoing agency policy, and the other is whether the particular issue or determination, the particular issue or determination is capable of repetition but evading review. The trial court found that it would evade review, but also found that it was not capable of repetition. We argue in our papers, of course, that there's no merit to this. In the last three applications that the IIP submitted, each one was rejected. The rationale was a little bit different, but there's no question that they believed what they said, that they made an honest effort to say what they thought was accurate, and that the agency will not change its mind. To suggest that the agency can change its mind in arbitrary and capricious fashion on the same facts just makes no sense. Nonetheless, that's what the trial court said. In terms of the statutory provisions, there's a question of whether or not what remedy is available to the court. And while it appears, although it's not necessarily perfectly accurate, while it appears that they cannot issue injunctive relief, certainly under the APA they can compel agency action unlawful.
Maybe before you get to relief, you should focus on whether there's been a violation of the statute or the regulation here.
Well,
you want to do that?
I'd be glad to, yeah. Judge mm-hmm. Tatel. The statute says that the Q1 intern or beneficiary has to be employed under the same wages and working conditions as domestic workers similarly employed. The agency said what that means is he needs to be employed and receive some wages.
Yeah, right.
And the problem with
what's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with that, Judge Tatel, is that there's a qualifier. It says what wages they need to employ or need to receive. And what one does is what the agency should have done is look for a paradigm worker, as they eventually did, look for a paradigm worker and then say they must be paid as, say, teacher's assistant. And the agency did not do that because in the last application that was submitted, all the duties of teacher assistants were specifically precluded. And nonetheless, the application was denied because they weren't paying appropriate wages. Therefore, a teacher assistant was not involved in terms of the determination. And as we point out in our papers, and in fact, the intern is not a teacher assistant.
Well, before you get to that, stick with the wages. What about the regulation, which says it does say comparable, but then it goes on and says that they have to have the financial ability to remunerate the wages. So the regulations are pretty clear that there has to be a wage. Isn't that the case?
No.
No?
No, what it says is they have to have whatever fine.
Well, then
let me rephrase that. Let me respectfully disagree. What it says, the regulation says that you have to have the financial ability to pay whatever the appropriate wage is.
Including nothing?
Including nothing. In other words, if in fact the regulation did not say that, then almost every other instance, there would be no requirement that they have the money to pay whatever wages is necessary. That is a fully appropriate regulation, but it's applied in each instance. For example, if in fact they were serving as a waiter at Disneyland, they would have to have the financial ability to pay a waiter at Disneyland whatever the going rate is for a waiter at Disneyland. And if it were something more important, like a lawyer, then they would have to be able to pay whatever lawyers get if they are in fact being lawyers. And so what it does is it accommodates whatever particular wage is necessary to pay the interns. And in this case, if it's zero, it's zero. In point of fact, they were paid $300 apiece a month. But for the purposes of our argument, that wasn't necessary. We did it because the program itself would not be successful if, in fact, the interns had to find a place to stay, and they could never do it for $200 a month if they had no spending money. What the program was all about is taking people who are willing to volunteer their time and putting them in a position where, in fact, they would be able to do that and facilitating their ability to do that. But the fact that it mentions a financial requirement merely means that whatever the wages are that has to be paid, you have to have the money to pay them.
Well, I'm hung up on the word employed, and who will be employed under the same wages and working conditions as domestic workers. I mean, you don't employ volunteers. I mean, you employ to me means that you pay them.
Well, under the Department of Labor regulations, they are in fact employees. They're covered by the Wage Act, but the Wage Act says, in fact, you don't have to pay them. If you look at the definition which the government supplied, it says wages which are usually paid, wages are usually paid in the form of money, but they don't have to be.
Well, is it clear that we use the Department of Labor definition?
Well, it is because that's what the USCIS uses. The USCIS cannot define employee in a different way than the Department of Labor. They can't, because in fact Congress was the author of both the Department of Labor statutes, and also the USCIS statutes. Now, in terms of what the wages should be, and in terms of what the occupational title should be, the USCIS could, in fact, make determinations like that, but they've chosen not to. What they did in this instance is they went to the Occupational Outlook Handbook and looked up something that they thought sounded sort of the same, although it wasn't, and said they really are teacher assistants. But they could have just as easily said these people are teaching about their native lands, they're really teachers. They could have chosen anything from that list, or they could have developed their own, but they chose not to. And I think we have to judge them on what they chose, and we have to use the Department of Labor definition, not only in the Occupational Outlook Handbook, the OOH, but also in the DOT, which is their Dictionary of Occupational Titles.
I'm curious about something. Prior to your Q1 petitions were granted routinely before these three, correct?
Right? That's correct.
Okay. Did the wage issue ever come up?
Never came up.
Never came up. So there's no previous decision saying wages aren't required, right? This is the first time the agency identified that. Is that right?
Well, there has never been an articulated decision, but the process that the agency follows is they take all the regulations and they review the petition.
Right.
And after reviewing the petition, if they meet all the regulations, then the petition's approved.
Right, but there's no, but I gather your answer to my question says that prior to these three, there was never a decision where the agency said these are okay even though no wages are being paid, correct?
But the,
I mean, they were just approved.
Well, I understand your question, Judge Tatel, and the reason I'm hesitating is there is no mechanism to, in fact, do that.
I see. Well, was there ever a letter or any advisory opinion or anything that ever said beyond the regulations that said you didn't need to have wages?
No, okay. And there's no advisory opinion or letter which, in fact, would accomplish that purpose. The process is, and I think it...
Well, I mean, did anybody, you never wrote to the agency and said, by the way, well, you know, our people aren't paid, is that okay? Or somebody else never did that? That's my question. In other words, prior to these three, this is the first time the agency has expressed any view about this subject beyond its regulation, right?
Well, I can't agree with you, Judge Tatel, and the reason I can't agree with you is you send in a petition, you say what you're giving them, right, specifically to meet that particular regulation.
Right.
The agency approves right. that application. That is, and then they send you a letter saying you're approved.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
In terms of the, I guess the bottom line is that the agency cannot change the requirement. And if, in fact, there are, you know, literally millions of people who...
They can't change what requirement?
They can't change the wording of the statute.
No, but
they also can't change their regulation.
But
the regulation
if we read, if we read the statute and the regulation as, first of all, I take it you would agree that the statute is at least ambiguous.
No.
No?
No,
you think the statute clearly does not require a wage. Is that your position?
My position is the statute clearly says that the wages that are to be paid are the wages of the domestic paradigm worker.
Okay, suppose I think that that leaves open the question of whether it's possible to have no wage, that is, to compare it to domestic workers who aren't paid anything. Just suppose I think that. That is, that it's ambiguous. Do you have a backup argument that the agency's regulation is an unreasonable interpretation of the statute?
No, I think, and I've said in my papers, that the agency regulation parallels the statute.
Okay, so
it clarifies a little bit of it because it says that it has to be in the same locality.
So your case rests entirely on the proposition that the statute clearly allows no wage to be paid if a comparable domestic worker receives no wage, right? That's your case.
In the case where the particular person is an employee under Department of Labor standards,
isn't it? Don't complicate my question. Your case rests on the proposition that the statute unambiguously unambiguously requires the agency to give a Q1 visa to an applicant who is paying no wages if comparable employees, domestic employees, receive no wages, correct?
That's my case.
That's your case.
I mean, there's an APA problem and a Regulatory Flexibility Act problem, but you are absolutely correct in saying that my case requires that the individual receive the comparable wage for the paradigm domestic worker, and in addition, that the paradigm domestic worker in this case is what the Department of Labor says it is, which is an unpaid intern. I'm not trying to avoid your question.
No, you answered it. Thank you.
Yeah.
No, you didn't avoid it. You answered it.
I've reserved some time, and I've eaten up into it, so I'll sit down now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Goldsmith?
Your Honor, may it please the Court, Aaron Goldsmith, on behalf of the government. Your Honor, I'd like to begin by addressing the issue of jurisdiction, specifically the issue of mootness. The question is whether or not IIP has met its burden of demonstrating the exceptional circumstances that would involve the application of the capable of repetition yet evading review exception to the mootness doctrine. And our position is that they cannot meet that burden based on their own admission on page 179 of the record. This was from a transcript of a hearing that the district court held on December 21st, 2010, in which the district court directly put the question to counsel regarding IIP's intentions. The question was, does your client have other petitions pending in other locations, or do they have other plans for assisting other foreign students right now? And the answer was no, nor can we. And then he proceeded with an explanation.
Well, but isn't that correct? I mean, as long as the agency's position is as it is, it would be futile to file another petition. And they say in their affidavit that if things change, they will.
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't understand your argument about that.
The district court could reasonably have found that there was not a reasonable expectation that this same dispute would reoccur between the two parties. And there's another sort of subtler reason.
You're not going to go to your next argument, are you really? That is, that the agency might change its mind?
No.
You're not serious about that one, are you?
Your Honor, our position is, are you really?
No. I didn't think
Your Honor,
so.
Okay. If they file another...
But somebody else put that in your brief, right?
Your Honor, I take full responsibility for any problems with this brief. But just to be clear, if they file another petition and they don't pay the participants' wages, there's no dispute that USCIS will deny it again. I just want to be very clear on that, that there was, with respect to the duration of the period, there's a question about documentation.
Let me go back to my question, okay? I'm looking at Mr. Schwartz's affidavit, mm-hmm. okay? IIP intends to file Q1 petitions in the future if this court resurrects its program. What more does he need to say? That's his affidavit.
Your Honor, that is what his affidavit says.
Right.
That's not in dispute. We point to this admission that was made in open court, and that the district court could properly rely on that admission.
We look at this de novo, don't we?
Correct.
Okay. And so what about this quote I just read you from the affidavit? Isn't that pretty dispositive about this question?
It's an important piece of evidence, Your Honor.
okay.
But there's something else I would like to say mm-hmm. on the issue of jurisdiction, and that is that there's a case law from this circuit that in terms of determining whether or not this exceptional exception applies to the mootness doctrine, you can look towards the complaint. And on the complaint, you see that there are 200 numbered allegations, approximately six, I think there are six different counts involving constitutional and statutory claims. And it's not the duty of the district court to look at all these different claims and pluck out those claims and determine which ones may be dispositive, which ones are pure questions of law, which ones are fact-specific, and then determine that if one of those issues is dispositive and it's a pure question of law, then there's a reasonable expectation that it will reoccur. That's not the obligation of the district court, and it's not the obligation of the government. It's the obligation of IIP to demonstrate that there is a reasonable expectation that the same dispute will apply. And in this case, we believe they have not done so. And I'd like to mm-hmm. Address the merits, which is the alternative argument. As it's been noted earlier, this is an employment-based visa. As Your Honor noted, the statute expressly uses the term employed. It speaks of being employed under the same wages and working conditions as domestic workers. And we believe that this language is clear that you have to pay wages and that the wages have to be more than zero. That if a statute used the word house, you would not refer to an empty lot as a type of house, a no house. And similarly, when a statute says wages, you wouldn't say that means the same thing as no wages. And our position is that they have simply failed to comply with the statutory requirement. The statute is clear on its face, and that's where we are on terms of what the statute says. There's also been earlier reference to the issue of the regulations and about the need to demonstrate the financial ability to remunerate the participants. And here we have a situation where the participants are simply not being paid. That's what the district court found, and there's no challenge to that here on appeal. We have an employment-based visa, a Q visa. There's a wage requirement, and that wage requirement is simply not being complied with. And
this thing about unpaid intern, where is that? I mean, where is that found in either the labor regulations or? I mean, is that a description of a employment status, an unpaid intern? Does that come? Is that listed anywhere where it's tied to employment?
That's not listed in any USCIS's regulations, and the issue here is just what the statute requires.
Mr. Schwartz said that unpaid intern is the closest what these folks do to what a domestic worker would do. And my question is there a group of employees or some people employed as unpaid interns in the Department of Labor or anywhere else?
Your Honor, I don't have the answer to the question. We recognize there is such a thing as a volunteer, but this is an employment visa, so that's not applicable. And what's more, what the agency found in its decision was that if there's a reference to evaluation forms, evaluating participants on their teaching skills, that suggests that they're not simply like a volunteer who shows up at a school and reads to children, but rather that they are involved in teaching. And that's also supported by the fact that we're talking about between 20 and 30 hours a week that participants will engage in. That's more than someone who is like a volunteer who shows up at school. So there's several arguments on the merits. There's the wage requirement in the statute. There's the language in the regulation. There's also this issue of whether or not they're teaching assistants or interns. I understand that opposing counsel disagrees with the agency's finding that they are teaching assistants, but I'm not sure what the legal argument is that USCIS's action was arbitrary and capricious. I understand they disagree with it.
Do we have to, if we were to agree with you about the wage issue, mm-hmm. do we even have to decide that question?
No, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The wage issue is dispositive.
Right. And do you agree with Mr. Schwartz that prior to these three petitions, the agency had never expressed its view, this issue had just not come up? I mean, it had granted petitions, right? But the issue of wages hadn't come up.
Yes, I agree that to the best of our knowledge, they've never expressed an opinion as to whether wages means no wages or has to involve financial enumeration. We've looked, and to the best of our knowledge, there's never been an expression of what it means. And as your Honor noted, there were previous petitions that were granted. It's not clear how many previous petitions were granted, but those are the facts as we understand them. But regardless of whether or not previous petitions were granted, there's a statutory requirement, and that statutory requirement is binding on the parties. And the question is simply, has IIP satisfied this wage requirement? And based on the facts and the administrative record, the district court properly found that they did not. So to sum up, we would say that this court lacks jurisdiction, but if it has jurisdiction, it should affirm the district court's finding on the basis that IIP simply did not satisfy the statutory and regulatory requirements for a Q visa. Thank you, Your Honor.
I do want to ask you one thing. These earlier petitions that have been granted, do we know or do we not know whether they included unpaid visitors?
We don't know.
Okay.
They very well may have. We don't know. Thank you.
Your point is that doesn't make any difference, right?
Your
point is it doesn't make any difference.
Correct.
That if they granted them and they were unpaid, they were wrong, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That it would be analogous to if there's a filing requirement with a clerk's office that you pay a certain filing fee when a complaint's filed, and if the clerk by mistake accepts a filing even though there's no filing fee, that's not an interpretation of the filing requirement. That's just a mistake. Thank you, Your Honor.
Right. How much time does Mr. Schwartz have? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the last point, this isn't a matter where the clerk makes a mistake. This is a matter where time after time the agency carefully reviews the petition and reaches a determination that it complies with the regulation. In terms of whether what the statute means, if you look at the legislative history, the House report, it says its purpose is to safeguard workers and to make sure that they aren't paid, as we point out in our paper, a lower salary if they're an intern. And that's exactly what happened here. These people are the equivalent of volunteers. They work hard. They're evaluated on their ability to transmit their cultural heritage as a teacher, but they're not teachers. And they are teacher's assistants for the same reason.
Where does the phrase unpaid intern come from? You used it as if it is in some sort of description of employment.
Well, I use it because there is an exception, and it's the source is a long internet link, I'm afraid, in my paper. But what the Department of Labor does, and what the agency, the federal agency that deals with volunteers, does is they've categorized these individuals as people who, in fact, do volunteer work and are not paid. And we included the president's latest statement on that in our papers. In terms of employment, they are, in fact, employed in doing a task. And that's why the Department of Labor had to say, if it's for a public agency, you don't have to pay them. If it's for a law firm, you do have to pay them. And finally, let me just say, this is not an employment visa. This is a cultural exchange visa. It's like the J-1 visa. Its purpose is to let the people in this country know about the different cultures. And, for example, if we find ourselves 2 weeks from now in war to protect South Korea, the fact that there have been maybe 200 or 300 Korean interns who've come to this country and taught about their culture and were exposed to Americans will be helpful in terms of the public reaction to what we're going to be doing. And that is why, on a broader sense, they have an International Education Week, and why cultural programs such as this are terribly important, and they cannot exist if they're to be paid as teachers or teachers' assistants, because the schools are not prepared and do not have the funds to have these programs otherwise. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Call the next